Please welcome Aaron Van Weerdem as the moderator for this panel. Please put your hands together.
Thanks, Stefan. Is this on? Looks like it's on. I think you guys can just come. So we have Adam Back, the CEO of Blockstream, and John Carvalho. I have to sit there? Why? Oh, okay. Yeah, very clever. Where's Giacomo? I didn't introduce Giacomo yet. This is Giacomo. He's the newly director of what was it again, Giacomo?
Plan B Network.
All right. Also, Jameson is on his way. Ah, here's Jameson. Jameson, the founder of Casa. Anything else we should mention there?
A million
Slayer of Satoshi.
Yeah, a million different projects and a slayer of Satoshi myths.
Right. And yes, I'm Aaron van Weerdem. I work for Bitcoin Magazine. I also just wrote a book about the origin story, the prehistory of Bitcoin. One of the panelists is actually in that book. I won't spoil who it is. All right. Ossification, Curse of Blessing. Okay, let's start. I know this is going to be a challenge. Just to be clear, we have 45 minutes. You'll have all the opportunity to elaborate your points later, but I want to start with a challenge. Let's start with a one-word answer, just to sort of set the stage here. So, ossification, curse or blessing? Is the curse or a blessing, Jameson?
Curse.
Blessing.
Curse.
Blessing.
All right. One more question. So is Bitcoin right now perfect? Is Bitcoin right now perfect as it is? Let's do it in the other way.
It's good enough.
Good enough?
Yeah, it's good enough.
Good enough, but very far from perfect. The two things go together.
Okay.
Definitely not perfect. Nothing will ever be perfect. But there still remains, a huge amount of things that can be improved.
All right. So let's start with Giacomo. You said blessing, right?
Yeah.
And you also said Bitcoin isn't perfect.
Yeah.
So if Bitcoin is not perfect, why is the blessing? Why is ossification a blessing?
Because the risk in changing Bitcoin to make it more perfect and the risk that this change goes bad and allows a hostile takeover, a corruption, I consider it way higher than the risk of not making it perfect and I just have to hack around it in other ways. A good example could be that after the last fixes of the screw-ups that Satoshi had to do at the end of 2010, every single life-threatening bug of Bitcoin was introduced and not discovered. There may be something that we will discover that will force us to change Bitcoin. And in that case, I think that we will have to change it without violating the meme of ossification. The fact that we say that Bitcoin should not change, and it's good that it's not changing, doesn't mean that if a life-threatening bug is discovered, it will not change. Of course, nobody will stay with a broken Bitcoin just to lose money. But the fact that the default is the status quo, I think is very powerful because the risk of corruption is higher than the risk of known evolution. In this case, Bitcoin, we say that it is anti-fragile. It's true that Bitcoin is anti-fragile as an ecosystem. Miners, developers of all the let's say stack of software that will change. Ossification doesn't mean that the software doesn't change. If you think about TCP/IP standard, the main rules of IP version 4 didn't change since the 80s. But the software managing it and the hardware managing routers changed dramatically. So the internet has changed completely from the 80s, but the main rules of IP version 4 basically did not. And that kind of ossification is a blessing because the amount of effort that will be put into corrupting it will be much higher than, in my opinion, that the attack surface of the current situation.
All right, the awkward thing, which we have only one mic, but does anyone want to respond to that?
I think that even though we got two different answers for your question that only had two options, I think we probably all agree on the nuances of it, and we just interpreted your question differently. Like, I don't think Adam or Giacomo thinks that we should ossify immediately or never change if we need to change. And I don't think that myself or Jameson Lopp are saying we need a lot of change so much as we should all be very conservative about what we do with Bitcoin, and that it's probably good enough as is. And as Giacomo kind of mentioned, that we've learned that a lot of the problems are introduced, not discovered. And so we have to be extremely conservative with how we approach changing Bitcoin or even adding features to it.
Anyone else? Yeah, Jameson, I think, wanted to say something as well.
Sure. It's a very complicated thing to talk about because a lot of what we're talking about is speculation on unknown unknowns. And so whenever you change software, there is risk of unknown unknowns of things going poorly. When you don't change software, there can also be unknown unknowns. And then the question becomes, you know, will we still be able to respond to these things? I do think there's an interesting historical context. We have decades of history of internet protocols. We can look at the TCP/IP stack, and it is not perfect by any means. In fact, you talk to any of the OGs from the Internet Engineering Task Force, and they will tell you one of their greatest regrets was that encryption was not made a default standard at the very lowest layers of the internet. So what happened? We had to hack it on at higher layers. There's also plenty of attacks and weaknesses that happen at different levels of the protocol stack. Like BGP, you know, routing attacks happen all the time. It would be better if that was not even possible. But, you know, the ability to even change things that are that low at the internet protocol stack is pretty much impossible these days. So, you know, I think this is one of those things where we all want to be conservative. We don't want to break anything. At the same time, we don't want to lose the ability for the system to react to changes in the world. And this is one of the main things that I've come to kind of settle on is that protocols ossify. We all agree that it's basically like a law of physics at this point. But the world does not ossify. And so the question becomes, how does a protocol respond to major changes in the world and the environment around it if something becomes a crisis?
Yeah, very Adam wants some opening remarks as well.
So when I first got like actively involved in Bitcoin in 2013, I went and tried to read everything I could find and talk on IRC to the developers to understand questions that's ambiguous. But one of the things I did is I went and read all of Satoshi Nakamoto's posts from the Bitcoin Talk Forum before he stopped writing there. And one of the very early ones was a short writing about ossification. And it's when you look at it in the context, it's amazing how early that was. I think it was like 2009, 2010. It basically says he rushed the scripting system for Bitcoin before releasing it.
So are you referring to the set in stone
line? Yes, that one. Yeah, exactly. So he wanted it to be set in stone so it wouldn't need to change. And so at least there's the intent, but it went badly wrong quite quickly because a number of the rushed opcodes turned out to have very bad bugs, and people fixed the issue by disabling a number of them. And so, you know, immediately Bitcoin lost the expressiveness for that objective to be met, which is that everything you might want to do could be done on top. And probably the script language is simpler and more restrictive and not quite enough to do everything we want to do. For example, you know, there were opcodes to support Lightning historically, and nowadays discussion of opcodes to help with LN symmetry, like a more efficient version of Lightning. So I think, you know, another type of ossification is there are some sort of core properties of Bitcoin. And Luke Dasher did a good presentation of this at one of the Bitcoin Latin America main conferences, just explaining the change process. And I mean, there's no governance process, right? But that there are some things which are inviolable, right? So you can have sort of opt-in soft forks if they don't hurt other people, they don't, you know, adversely affect security, they're opt-in and backwards compatible. But most other things are, intentionally ossified, and you know, if you try to change them, I mean, some things become hard forks, which obviously are much more difficult, but even soft fork things that indirectly violate those core principles, you know, you'd have a kind of another community block size war type of argument, right? So I think it is, you know, quite immutable. But then the question is, you know, how do we get to a stage where Satoshi's original objective to make it more layered so that you can build everything you need on top without needing more things, that we don't know how to do yet, right? And that's what, so that's why people are working on opcodes to fill in gaps.
Shall I go to my follow-up question, or did you want to add something, Giacomo?
Just a very quick objection to Jameson's, which is that I think that the changes to Bitcoin and what the changes to Bitcoin could do is actually an unknown unknown. While what can happen to Bitcoin if we don't change, I think it may be closer to a known unknown. I mean, we don't know how much, when, if, but the amount of the possible range of attacks on the current design, I think has been explored very much, going from mining incentive failures to network censorship. I don't think there is a lot of unknown unknown into not changing. Of course, that may be pretentious because, well, I mean, the universe could change in very different ways, including a solar flare that would destroy electronics, but even that has been discussed on Bitcoin Talk. So I would say that it's not symmetric. Like, you're right, but it's not symmetric. The what can happen with change is literally unbounded. What can happen with not changing is can be bad, but I think we have some paranoid perception of it.
We can also talk about known unknowns, or even known knowns, right? And I think this is where the nuance gets really complicated. And Adam spoke about inviolable properties. And I've written up, like, trying to, you know, get an idea of what are the inviolable properties. Once again, this is one of those things where it can be very hard for anyone to say these are the inviolable properties because, you know, there is no authority to dictate that. But, you know, we know, for example, what the current scaling, on-chain scaling properties of Bitcoin are. And we know, at least I would say we probably agree, that we believe that self-custody is very important, you know, not your keys, not your coins. And some of these inviolable properties are actually in conflict with each other. You know, how it's not currently possible to get 8 billion people, you know, into self-custody in Bitcoin. This is one of those things, and you know, maybe this is a pie in the sky unicorn decision or wish for Bitcoin, but right now we don't have a way, you know, to get to a world where we have mainstream adoption where we aren't trading off some of these properties. You know, basically 99% of the world would have to have Bitcoin IOUs if we went mainstream right now with like the current technology stack. And of course, people are working on solutions to that with different trade-offs.
Yeah, so that's an argument in line of Bitcoin is actually far from perfect, right? John, do you want to comment on that? Okay, so, or Adam, maybe?
I mean, I'll only let you get to your question, but I think, you know, one of the big debates is, you know, as enthusiasts about Bitcoin, we want everybody who could be interested to be able to benefit from the properties. But in a block size wars, basically, in a rush to do that, some people became happy to degrade what Bitcoin's providing. So we could provide very, very weak, almost meaningless assurances to everybody, or strong assurances to the limit of the technology. And the market shows, you know, in terms of the investors and which forks they supported, right, that Bitcoin remained Bitcoin. And that was, well, we're going to provide a strong assurity and try to improve that scalability and access later and not degrade it to lowest common denominator.
Yeah, I do have one comment, which is we may not know how to get 8 billion people on Bitcoin quickly, but we do know how to do it within the known knowns and what we have today. It's just basically, as James was saying, Jameson was saying, it's a little bit in conflict with some of what we want, which is basically we could scale Bitcoin on chain. Like, we could just make the blocks as big as necessary, when necessary, and this kind of thing, increasing the cost of running a node. But if we do it gradually, you know, in tandem with Bitcoin adoption, it might work just fine to do that. And instead, in the meantime, while we deal with that limitation. We make things like Lightning and other experiments to see if we can offload some of that onboarding.
Building on this, I think that the kind of consensus that ossified on the social layer about block size, for example, after rewards, may be a parody of the nuanced argument. There is no argument that the block should never be larger or maybe some exhibit some kind of flexibility like in Manny Rosenfield's proposal of elastic blocks. Adam himself is a big blocker. He was like 8, 16. He made a proposal to increase significantly. The point was that changes of this scale should never happen in a rush, like sky is falling, Bitcoin is dead, we have to change, otherwise children are dying. We should basically have a clear view of the trade-offs. And in this case, the trade-off is spending versus verification. For example, if we had Zero Sync is doing a great job about zero-knowledge proof synchronization. If that kind of stuff became super trusted, super mainstream, and you could sync with a compact proof, a full node, or a proof of that, for that, in Africa on a cell phone under Tor, well, at that point, the discussion will change. Maybe it will be too late to change it anyway, because at this point, the certification will prevent the discussion, but it's still possible. And the second thing about, for example, 8 billion users having private keys and sharing some UTXO will be UTXO sharing. Lightning Network is a very poor UTXO sharing, just two people sharing a UTXO. But there are clear ways to improve that into multi-part UTXO sharing. Lightning symmetry is very clear, even if we trade off. The point is that even needed? We don't even have the push to that. We don't even have the pressure to go there because nobody cares. People are still happy with custodianship because they are not being seriously attacked yet. Yes, sometimes the exchange will run with the money like FTX. Sometimes you may have some censorship like in Canada or North Korea or other countries like that. But most of the time, if you just open a wallet of Satoshi, nobody's coming to censor you for that money. Nobody's coming to steal from you. So there is no incentive yet, but incentive will come. And our best friends into evolving that direction will be our adversaries that will actually make clear again why we do need self-sovereignty. So I'm very optimistic about that problem.
So in general, it sounds that the main argument against changing Bitcoin, you mentioned the unknowns, is this actually a failure of the peer review process? And can that be improved? It seems like that's what essentially the problem is then, right? You can't find potential problems with whatever upgrade anyone proposes.
Well, a few things. So one, there's a difference between speculative and prescriptive change. And a lot of the culture in Bitcoin Core and in Bitcoin right now is for speculative change. It's saying, if we add this, we may be able to do this, and we may get more Bitcoin fees or more users, et cetera. But it's not coming from demand, so it's not prescriptive. It's just, which a prescriptive example might be, oh, the blocks have been full for 9 months, and fees have risen to $500 a transaction, and we have a lot of people that want to use Bitcoin, and the price is starting to go down. Then you might say, okay, well, let's make the blocks bigger. Let's finally have that conversation again. So as far as prescriptive versus speculative, well, we're mostly most of this is speculative. And when you have scaling that is unrealized, basically you speculate, you take a risk, the cost of that scaling is bared by the existing user base. And so you have to fulfill that scale in order to have justified that speculation. And we don't always do that. And when you're speculating, you're basically in an oppressive position because you're coming down from this trusted process where you have, protocol engineers that make proposals and reach a intra-consensus between them. But then beyond that, everything is like trickle-down trust, where it's like, oh, I know a core dev, and I agree with him, and he says this is cool, so I'm going to do some superficial or even deep attempt to understand it, and then I'm going to promote it to people, and we're all going to help activate it. But the truth is, you can't come anywhere near close to unanimous, active, willing agreement for any kind of activation or any kind of change. So it's always oppressive in some way because you're leaning on the ignorance of the people that don't know the true repercussions of the change.
Yeah, I mean, I think the, in a way, it's a lot easier to have change which is, you know, not understood by absolutely everybody. And when the change is opt-in, right? So it, where it doesn't really cost other people anything other than, you know, the risk of the change itself and upgrading some software. And most, you know, I think all of the recent changes are, you know, soft forks like Taproot is a good example, right? Just makes a more compact signature. You know, adds some ability to do some sort of more efficient, complicated scripts that you only reveal if you use them, things like that. I would say the about ossification, I'm more concerned about long-term things where, you know, for people who've been in Bitcoin for 5 years or some period, you've seen it evolve where, you know, there are bigger entities getting involved, you know, ETFs, big financial companies, you know, even the beginnings of sovereign wealth funds and countries buying a Bitcoin treasury, public market companies buying a Bitcoin treasury. And, you know, if you'd asked people if they'd expected any of that 5 years ago, they would have said, well, maybe in 30 years or something. So, like, Bitcoin, we didn't notice because we're in the moment, but, you know, the trajectory is scarily fast. And so what I'm thinking is that, you know, if that continues for another 5 years in a similar kind of thing, and, you know, there are G7 countries with Bitcoin on their balance sheet or something, now you have, like, if there's any kind of change process and they get into another, you know, Bitcoin Genesis block-like situation, you know, they're having a financially hard time and they want to increase the number of Bitcoins drastically for an emergency reason or something, you know, at that point, it's better if Bitcoin is digital gold and there's no change process and we're trying to, like, disable soft forks or something, right? I mean, because the problem with a change process is that people who are good at bureaucracy come and try to take it over and overwhelm it. And that there's a history of that in the ITF as well. So there's a blog post written by Alex Bergeron, I think it's called the Tower of Bitcoin or something like that. And it's all about the history of how a lot of big companies tried to take over the ITF and ultimately lost. And I think Bitcoin's closest analogy to that was a block size war. But we don't want a repeat of the block size war, you know, with the World Bank and, like, international financial organizations and government monetary policy committees. So I think the race is on to, like, ossify it for real.
Yeah, well, let me ask a question about this then. So what you've been describing right now is what you would like Bitcoin to be or what you think would be a good idea for Bitcoin. And some people also speak of ossification as sort of an inevitability. I've been personally kind of reconsidering that stance myself and seeing it more as an incentive system. So the most obvious example of that would be miners can, if they have a majority, soft fork the protocol. It depends a little bit on what you consider a soft fork, but they can at least, you know, they can soft fork, practically speaking, at least. So I'll let you respond in a second. Similarly, Shaolin Fry was, you know, maybe one guy, and he made a UASF. Now we've also been talking about URSFs, and then you can potentially have a chain split. The market can decide, figure it out, and no one could have stopped Shaolin Fry from doing that. So, isn't ossification maybe just not actually true? Like, in the end, individuals or miners can just do whatever they want. No one can stop them. So, is that maybe the future for Bitcoin? There will just be. It will just. It depends on incentives much more than what we want it to be.
Well, first of all, the example of the internet is already like that. The ossification of IP version 4 that Adam was mentioning, yeah, the post by Alex is very, very good. You really see these companies trying to change the internet and the internet just not caring, which is good. That's ossification. It also has problems, like Jameson said. Well, I mean, there is no privacy at the base layer. There are a lot of problems. But internet is ossified still. Every internet company, every ISP could change it. They're, in theory, just like you say, it's just incentive. But those incentives are part of the practical ossification. It's not a theoretical one. Everything can happen. If we move all the population of the Earth in some location and jump, maybe we can change the rotation of the Earth. Yeah, that's theoretically possible, but that's not going to happen. So the point is that, practically speaking, the Internet Protocol version 4 is ossified. Bitcoin is the same. Shaolin Frey could do whatever he wants. But practically speaking, if we didn't win the bluff, the chicken game with UASF, most likely we will not have Seguin. That was, I will not going to run for real and incompatible not. And I think there are other people like me. So what really won was not Wex. So the resistance to the hard fork was an uncontroversial win, while the imposition of Seguit was only possible because nobody really had anything against Seguit. And to miners soft forking, that's not entirely true, because the point, miner can censor, and that's a given. We know that miners can censor on-chain. They cannot censor second layers, but they can censor on-chain. And when they censor, they could, of course, censor conditionally. That means that it can temporarily impose any kind of a new rule, which is a soft fork. But only while their will and power and capability goes on, they can censor. Whenever this majority stops, let me give you an example. We have miners censoring every transaction that is not respecting some rule. Now, I create a transaction with a very huge fee that breaks that rule. And now everybody with a child pay for parent piles on me. And that becomes basically $2 billion on top of that one transaction. Some miner will take the risk. That's not happening with a soft fork, because the miner knows that even if they take that money, all the blocks of the economy will invalidate the blocks. So the risk is too high. But if when it's just miners imposing, you just need miners defeating. And miners are very easy to bribe, because that's, I mean, they are prostitutes in a technical way. I mean, they just go.
Yeah, but that, I don't want to become a panelist myself, but doesn't that also apply to, for example, a US, like if a group of users enforces the same thing that miners are enforcing, now the incentives might shift into keeping these rules. Jameson.
Yeah, I think there's a million different ways you can sort of slice and dice the proposals. John hit on something I think is a good way of doing of the, you know, prescriptive versus speculative. And if we look at the block size wars, this was a prescriptive kind of top-down from a bunch of companies, because really what they wanted was they didn't want to have to do the work to use Bitcoin more efficiently. They wanted to offload the cost of using Bitcoin more efficiently onto the network to make the network basically work less efficiently. That was a very obvious, you know, trade-off that, you know, the rest of the world said, no, we don't want to have to take on all of this, you know, extra data and processing. On the other hand, you know, we have a bunch of nerds who are kind of feeling around, trying to figure out like what are the different directions that the protocol could go in. What are the primitive functions that could be used at a protocol level to do more interesting things, either on the base layer or on second layers? And so, you know, if we look at the history of the protocol changes over the past decade or so, we could say, you know, what would have happened if the protocol had ossified in 2015? You know, what if we didn't have check lock time verify or SegWit or whatever? Like, obviously, the state of Bitcoin and what you could do with the protocol would be very different. Over the past more recent years, you know, we've had some other people suggesting protocol changes that are a bit more complicated, but are also speculative, whether it's stuff, you know, covenants style stuff, op check template verify, I believe, which did not, I guess it was not sufficiently convincing to people that like the use cases and the demand were there. Now, several years later, we have other people coming in saying, okay, I want to do op vault, which is a much more limited type of covenant functionality. Oh, by the way, we have discovered that, you know, check template verify is actually quite complementary with this. So it is an interesting process of discovery where we're trying to figure out like what are the building blocks that could be useful. But it's very hard to work backwards to have people who are like already living 5 or 10 years in the future, like in their head, and saying, okay, if we have these things, then we'll have this unicorn Bitcoin that can do everything for everyone, and we don't have to, you know, have the trade-offs of some of these inviolable properties.
In light of the oppressive nature of this, though, you have to still go back to that everything he's describing, while you can rationalize it, is still speculative. And so you're always just trusting the developers of Covenants, Op Vaults, et cetera, that this is actually going to be safe and can't be combined with other things like Taproot scripting to do, you know, unforeseen harm. Also, since UASF came up, I think it's more interesting for you, rather than saying that miners could soft fork, to mention, like you mentioned, the reverse, where I think that UASF, it could be argued, is kind of one of Bitcoin's flaws. I think that you could UASF by a minority, and miners have no clear way of measuring the actual adoption of a UASF. And so they...
Well, I think futures markets can help with that, but that's another topic.
Well, they can help, sure, but that's extra Bitcoin, right? It's outside of Bitcoin. And so Bitcoin itself can't provide what is necessary to give any confidence to a miner as to whether to activate or not. So they're inclined to start activating as soon as they feel like they're going to risk orphans. And so this is a very, you know, oppressive way by the minority to be able to make a soft fork. So again, a reason to be, you know, careful with any ideas of changing Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think in a way, one of the things Bitcoin has is, of course, as Giacomo was saying, IPv4, the internet is very layered, and it's easy to build different protocols, even relatively low-level protocols on top of IP and UDP and ICMP and things like that. But with Bitcoin, it's a bit difficult to transfer the security properties to the layer above, and I think that's one of the technical challenges we face. But There are a couple of things which are, so in 2013, I think Peter Todd and I had this massive 4-hour phone conversation because we were both thinking about client-side validation types of things. And it turns out, it was all in search of if it's possible to modularize Bitcoin. And so the idea is that the sort of base layer of mining, producing blocks, processing sort of minimal simple transactions and the fees, and that other things could potentially be negotiated between clients if you just sort of had the blockchain commit to the data that they're exchanging. And in that model, different subgroups of users could be using different script systems or different versions of script systems. And as long as, because they have to like verify the thing they're receiving, and that's up to them, right? So, and then they can respend it. So it sort of makes it a bit more lightning-like, where you can relax the sort of need for miners to bitwise verify that, otherwise you get a consensus fork. So anyway, it's that line of thing is continuing in RGB, like they formalized that and it implemented it. So it has some other trade-offs, so it's not necessarily simple. And I think the other thing where you see the discussion about the opcodes, right, so is that it's a kind of language design situation. And whenever you have a language design, it gets contentious because it's sort of aesthetics, right? You know, you're designing a CPU and you want to add some opcodes to accelerate graphics, and there are different ways to do it. And so people will be championing different ways, and other people will say, well, I want to do that, just do it with the irregular CPU instructions, keep it RISC. And so a lot of the argument is kind of bike shedding, right? It's like, which opcode should we do? How many opcodes can we tolerate, you know, every few years? The rate of change is annoying. Like, lots of changes creates RISC. Even a attitude of encouraging condoning change too much is RISC, right? Because that encourages more change later, which, you know, the current users and investors may have less control of once banks are involved, or central banks. So I think the idea of simplicity, which is a kind of V2 script idea that's been around since 2012 or something in IRC, and Blockstream has been working on for a while now, is a sort of soft forkable script system. So upgrade Bitcoin script, and the characteristics of that are a little bit interesting because it's extremely low level, and it's just like 9 bit level logic operators. And so then there's less debate, right? The question is, do you want Bitcoin to be extensible or not? You can't really say, well, let's have a 10th operator because you don't need it, right? And so arguably with that, it could be the last soft fork in a manner of speaking, because all of the current opcodes can be implemented with that level of thing. Now, you do have software upgrades to optimize common things, but they don't change the semantics. So I think that's potentially a longer-term route to get to ossification, but it's a big change.
Right. One of the great sort of open questions in Bitcoin, I think, anyways, is how do we upgrade Bitcoin if we want to upgrade Bitcoin? So in the early days, Satoshi was basically the benevolent dictator. Then at some point, miner activated soft forks were discovered. We had UASFs with the Taproot. We had speedy trial. What are your thoughts on if we're going to have another, presumably a soft fork? I don't think a hard fork is going to happen anytime soon. What are your thoughts on what would be the way to activate that?
Personally, I'm extremely conservative, and so I'm hesitant that I would ever really fully endorse another soft fork unless it was prescriptive, then maybe. And in that case, like, I'm not really an expert on all the activation options, but I would say something more like how, like when we did Taproot and SegWit, like being able to accumulate and somehow measure the whole network in as confidently as possible, so at least we know everybody is ready. That's good.
Do you mean the nodes? Do you mean counting nodes?
This is the problem.
Which is very Sybil attackable.
I don't know how to do this in a non-Sybil way. I'm just saying an ideal would be you would want to know that actually everybody supported the change. And that's probably impossible. Yeah, it's probably impossible.
Yeah, I also agree. Basically, the main point is that we must not have a predictable governance process. If we don't have it, then we may have changes when needed, but any attacker cannot predict the risk of trying to impose a change that is not needed. As example, if you have the game of chess, is it possible that human beings will change the rules? Yes. I mean, if they really need it, they will. Human beings are very flexible. But is there any kind of governance flow to change the rules of chess? You can just change the federation, the International Federation, which is a political body, but then people will keep playing chess in the same way. Players will just quit the federation. So it's good that there is no process to change Bitcoin that can be predicted and measured, because if there was, the attacker could actually try to estimate the budget to attack Bitcoin. Let's say one way of possibly upgrading Bitcoin that I think is very possibly interesting and funny is we discussed it many times, side chains. Of course, Blockstream is working on that since the very beginning, but it's very hard to do two-way peg in a trusted way. So a possible option would be one-way peg. So basically, you burn Bitcoin and you get this side coin on another system. The interesting thing about this process is that if you're really convinced that you find that you found a great and controversial upgrade to Bitcoin, that would be a very good test. Just burn a coin and get your side coin. If you're right, we will all migrate there eventually, and the last man migrating will not lose any money because the price of Bitcoin and the side coin will still is capped. So basically, while the new system will draw demand from Bitcoin, it will also draw supply. So basically, in 100 years, the last man will migrate without any kind of price difference. Unless you are afraid that this side coin will go to zero because nobody uses it. Ah, but that's the point. Nobody will use it. It's not really necessary. So I think, I mean, probably I'm lonely on this, but I think that proof of burn could be a nice proposal. I mean, do you want a confidential transaction on Bitcoin? Sure. Do a burn coin. Let's see if people want it. If they do, the price will be the same as Bitcoin. If they won't.
Jameson, how do we upgrade Bitcoin?
I'm not worried about that. I think it's kind of a meta governance thing of like, it's not possible for someone to impose a process in the first place. And it should be a big red flag if there is ever an official process. I'll kind of close my time by saying, I think there are two types of changes to Bitcoin that we should continue pushing forward and exploring. One is things that will improve permissionless innovation, aka changes that will make it so that people can go off and do whatever the hell they want without having to go through this process, because we don't have to worry about them potentially breaking Bitcoin. The other is things that help the Bitcoin base layer act as a cryptographic accumulator of sorts, aka things that allow you to do functionality that would be really, really difficult or really hacky to try to put together on a second layer. These are basically efficiency and scalability improvements.
Adam, last words for you. How to upgrade Bitcoin?
Yeah, I mean, I think actually the fundamental is the economy, the market is actually deciding. I mean, it's like gold. You know, if you mine lead, the gold bugs won't buy it. And that's the bottom line, right? So if you change Bitcoin in some way that people don't like, or they don't like the way you changed it, even if they like the feature, they're just going to refuse to buy it, and the miners will stop or go bankrupt. And that's basically what's happened in the past. And I think everything else is just convenience around it. So while people are looking at UASF as a dramatic thing, the earlier forks were just like that. Economic nodes upgraded with a bit of lead time. The miners followed, and that was that, right? If the miners mine something invalid, they lose money. That's their problem. And so the whole idea of even involving miners was just a convenience. Wait for all the nodes to upgrade, ask the miners to set a date. But, you know, you can just set a date that is in the future, and at that point it becomes active.
All right, that's our time. Thanks for being here. Thanks to the panelists. And enjoy the rest of the conference.
Great.